Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We have something new on our webpage, by the way. It's our online video picks. Every week we'll choose five videos from the web, which I anchor in our picks video. This week they include a clip of Karl Rove when he was an unknown college student working for the Nixon campaign. And four others, check out our online video picks at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. My guest now has been described as Darwin's Rottweiler, a scientist and an atheist. He's come to the conclusion that religious belief is not only irrational, but harmful, a case he makes in his latest book, The God Delusion, which was published in 2006 by Houghton Mifflin. He is a renowned zoologist, evolutionary biologist, and best-selling author, and he teaches at Oxford University, where he is professor of the public understanding of science. Richard Dawkins, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
He's in New York today, by the way, to accept the Lewis Thomas Prize at Rockefeller University. Maybe some of you, as I did, read Lewis Thomas's essays on science, which certainly contributed to the public understanding. So congratulations on that prize, Dr. Dawkins. I see you're not wearing your Atheists for Jesus t-shirt today. You have such a shirt?
I do have such a shirt. I wrote an article in the magazine Free Inquiry called Atheists for Jesus. And then somebody presented me with a t-shirt, which I occasionally enjoy wearing.
What's the basic Atheist for Jesus argument?
Jesus was a very good man. If Jesus had been alive today, and if he had known what we know, he would be an atheist.
And do you think religion in and of itself is fundamentally harmful?
Well, I don't want to stress that too much. I mean, in your introduction, you rather implied that that was the main point of the God delusion. The main point of the God delusion is that God doesn't exist. It's a matter of scientific truth. However, having established that in the first half of the book, the second half of the book does then go on to point out some of the bad things that do flow from widespread faith.
Well, let's go to that first half of the book. Why are you so sure that God doesn't exist?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I have a 7-point scale ranging from totally sure that God exists, which is number 1, to totally sure that God doesn't exist, which is number 7, and 50-50 is right in the middle in number 4. I'm about a number 6.8, meaning that I cannot disprove the existence of God, but in the same sense as I cannot disprove the existence of fairies. So my agnosticism is the same as my agnosticism about the existence of fairies. I would be very, very surprised if there was any sort of God.
Why wouldn't the scientific position be a 4 on a scale of 7? The pure agnostic's position that says, since there's no way to prove and no way to disprove the existence of God, this is just a realm out of my comprehension.
Well, a lot of scientists do say that, but now apply that to fairies again. I mean, you cannot disprove fairies, but no scientist has a kind of 50-50, who's going to make a 50-50 bet on fairies. We will, if we're good scientists, we'll say, well, I cannot actually disprove fairies, but I don't think that the odds are 50-50. I think the odds are 99% against.
So how'd you get to 6.8?
Well, firstly, the onus would be on a believer to show that there is some positive evidence, because it's not just God and fairies. There's an infinite number of things that you could believe in that you can't disprove. So there has to be some sort of positive reason. If you look at the positive reasons for some kind of supernatural being, most of them are completely valueless. The only one that is seriously considered today is the so-called argument from design. If you look around the world, if you look around especially
design.
At the living world.
Right.
It's just so amazing.
It fits together so well, and it's so complex that how could this not have come from someone's imagining?
Exactly. Well, the answer to that, firstly, is that until Darwin came, that might have been a reasonable position. After Darwin, we now know that there is an alternative. It's a more economical, more plausible alternative, and all the evidence points to it being correct.
But wait, why do those two have to be mutually exclusive? There's something called, what is it, Darwinistic theism, which says there could have been a God that set all of this in motion at the time of the Big Bang, or however it all began, and so God and Darwin are not incompatible.
There is a strand of thought that says that, and that God somehow set the evolutionary process in motion, or started it off and then sat back and watched, or even guided it through certain difficult parts. It's such an amazingly uneconomical way of looking at it. That's not the way science works. You don't put forward a highly comprehensive, elegant, beautiful theory that explains everything and then say, oh, and by the way, God's there too. I mean, it's completely superfluous. You don't need it. Not only do you not need it, but it's an addition of something very, very complicated and improbable in its own right.
Right. You don't need it because it's not the job of science to go there. It's the job of science to explain how the natural laws work. But then isn't it kind of, again, not provable, not disprovable, irrelevant to science to say, well, this could have been started by a theistic moment or not.
When you think about what the evolution theory is doing for us, it's explaining the existence of organized complexity. It's explaining the existence of brains and eyes and legs and wings and all these things which would otherwise baffle us. Now consider what God is like from that point of view. God would be another amazingly complicated, statistically improbable entity. And so by suddenly postulating a God that started it all off, you're undoing all your good efforts in using science to explain the existence of organized complexity. You're saying, well, we've got this theory that explains organized complexity, but we're going to start things off with even more organized complexity.
So what came before the beginning of time?
Nobody knows that, and that's what physicists are working on. But whatever else it was, it wouldn't have been complex. It would have been something simple. And physicists are now working on that. They haven't yet come up with an answer. But already they can say that whatever else the answer is, it certainly won't help to postulate a highly complicated intelligence, which is the kind of thing that comes into the universe late, at the end of a long process of evolution.
Do you think that science could ever explain infinity, the beginning of time, the reaches of space?
I'm not a physicist, and you'd have to talk to physicists about that. I don't know whether science will ever explain some of these deep problems. But what I am sure of is that if humanity ever does understand these deep problems, like infinity, like the origin of all things, the origin of physics, it will be science that explains it. It most certainly will not be theology.
The God Delusion is the name of the book by evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. I'll say we can take your phone calls for him, and it's a good thing I'll say that because 8 of our 10 lines are already full. So for the other two, it's 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or you can email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. Why don't you put on your headphones, Dr. Dawkins, and we'll take a phone call right now from George in Hoboken. Hi, George. You're on WNYC.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. Thank you.
I guess my comment and question is something as follows. While quite an admirer of Dr. Dawkins, I think the impression I got in reading his book was that he sets up a bit of a straw man, that his conception of God is kind of like the old man with the long white beard sitting in a rocking chair. As opposed to more nuanced conceptions. I mean, you might see a connectivity throughout the universe. You might see an intelligence embedded in that, and you might find that gives some sort of transcendence to your existence.
Okay, so does it matter what kind of God?
The old man with a long white beard is a great bore. I explicitly disavow that in the book. I anticipate that people are going to say, you're talking about an old man with a beard, and I explicitly say, no, I am not talking about an old man with a beard. The problem with the old man with a beard is that he makes people think that they can get out of answering the criticisms by saying, oh, you're only talking about an old man with a beard. And that's a disguise for the fact that what you actually believe in is not a whole lot less absurd. We are talking about any kind of supernatural creator, which, as I've said before, is superfluous. I most certainly am not talking about an old man with a beard, and I fully accept that you're not either.
What made you feel, and thank you for your call, George, what made you feel that now is the moment to write this book? Was there a moment, was it 9/11, the intelligent design movement, the ban on stem cell research, anything in particular?
Well, all of those probably helped. I did propose writing the book to my literary agent about 7 years ago, and he was dead against it. He said you couldn't sell a book against God.
How's it doing?
It's doing very well. And he changed his mind after 6 years, and I'm not sure what he thought had changed, but I should think it might have been 6 years of Bush, it might have been 9/11, it might have been stem cells, all those things that you suggested.
Are you trying to shock your reader into thought rather than hand-holding them? The examples you use, some of them, like equating parents who send their children off to religious instruction with child abusers, seem to be so provocative.
Yes, that's not quite right, actually. I use the phrase child abuse not for religious education, but for religious labeling. I think that actually labeling a child as, say, a Catholic child or a Protestant child or a Muslim child, that I think is child abuse. But I don't think that religious instruction is child abuse. Far from it. I actually am rather in favor of instructing children in comparative religion, because religion is such an immensely important part of our world. You can't begin to understand history without it. You can't understand literature.
That would be an intellectual pursuit rather than religious training.
Exactly.
Learning about religions. I mean, but if you're a Jewish or a Christian or a Muslim family living in a community of people within your religion, to raise a child in the religion and identify them as such until they're old enough to decide otherwise, that's comparable to child abuse to you?
Well, It's a difficult one. In most forms of it are mild enough that it doesn't really matter that much. I often use the comparison, you would never dream of calling a child a Marxist child or a secular humanist child or a monetarist child. So we're already quite used to the idea that children are too young to know where they stand on political or economic matters. Religion does seem to be the one exception, and it's not clear to me why we should allow it to be the one exception. So I think that what's right is to tell a child there are all these religions and these people believe this and those people believe that and they're historically important and so on. What's wrong is to say you are a Catholic child and therefore because Catholics believe this, you believe this. That I think is wicked.
Stephen in Greenpoint, you're on WNYC with Richard Dawkins. Hello, Stephen.
Hello. Very nice to hear. Very good conversation. I'm not completely religious, and I can understand where religion comes from. I just personally think that the worship of God is probably the most personal, most private thing a human being can practice. I just need to know why it's so important that people need to believe that there is a God, a generalized God, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you for your call.
Yes, I don't know why. There does seem to be a need for it. It's not a universal need. I mean, not everybody seems to have that need. I suppose part of it is a need for understanding. We crave explanation for our own existence, the existence of the universe, and that religion historically attempted to provide. It provided the wrong answers. Now we have the right answers, or we're getting there. So science takes over from religion there. Another of the things that religion provides is some sort of comfort, consolation, if you're afraid of death or if you're bereaved, if you long for some justice which you're not getting in this world, you hope for it in the next. So that could be another reason why people, quote, need it. But it's very important to say that because you need something, that doesn't make it true. I mean, we all need consolation, and I could say that I need to... suppose I was dying of cancer. I could say, I need to believe that I haven't got cancer. But if I have got cancer, I'm afraid needing to believe that I haven't is not going to help. What matters is what's true.
Well, as an evolutionary biologist, looking at how religious the world is, do you think there's been some Darwinian advantage for religious people?
That's a very interesting question. My own suspicion is the answer is probably strictly no, but the true answer is probably that there has been an evolutionary advantage to a psychological disposition, or maybe a constellation of psychological dispositions, which in other contexts have Darwinian survival value, but which manifest themselves as religion under the right cultural context.
What might one of those other things be?
Well, one of those other things might be the need for children to believe what their parents tell them. I mean, that could be an immensely valuable survival advantage in a Darwinian sense, because the child is immensely vulnerable. Parents have wisdom that they can impart for how to survive in a dangerous world.
History tells us that first children do, second children don't.
Yes,
right?
Well, that's an interesting point. I think you're quoting the work of Frank Salloway, the
among
historian.
Among others, yeah.
Yes. Well, that is an interesting point, but that's a subtlety. I mean, the more general point is that a child survives better if it believes what its parents tell it. And so the rule of thumb that we built into the child brain is believe what your parents tell you. But that doesn't provide automatically, obviously doesn't provide a way of distinguishing that which is good to believe and that which is bad to believe. And so any kind of nonsense that the parent chooses to impart will be believed and will be passed on to the next generation, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, and so on.
93.9 AM 820 WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer with the evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. Maybe you know his book, The Selfish Gene. His latest book is The God Delusion, published by Houghton Mifflin, and he teaches public understanding of science at Oxford University. Ernie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. As an atheist who believes people have a finite mind and an infinite universe, I have a question for Dr. Dawkins. How do you feel about the discrimination against atheists in this country, where a politician who said he didn't believe in God couldn't be elected dog catcher? And is this not related to the fact that people say almost virtually that religion and morality are virtually identical, when morality was actually learned by mankind many years ago as doing the greatest good for the greatest
number? All
right,
so there are a couple of questions in there, really. I think one of them is about discrimination against atheists in the political sector,
right,
and elsewhere.
First of all, I understand that the discrimination is not official. I don't think there are any laws on statute books in any state that say that an atheist can't hold public office. The discrimination comes in the electability, and so in a way, it's up to the electorate. If the electorate doesn't want to elect people who have red hair, it's up to them. They are free to vote down anybody who has red hair. So the task that atheists have is to present a better public image, to explain that actually atheists are perfectly reasonable people, they're nice people, they're moral people, or they can be just as much as anybody else. They don't have two horns and a tail. They are not fundamentally immoral. It's amazing the number of misconceptions people have, and that comes on to the second part of the question. There are people who think that you cannot be moral if you're an atheist. I was on a radio talk show last year in which somebody came on and said that if he didn't believe in God, he would promptly go out and murder his neighbor. So I said, are you serious? You'd go out and murder your neighbor? He said, yes, I would. And so I was able to point out to him that that's not a very good reason for being moral. If the only reason you don't murder your neighbor is that you're frightened of God, isn't that a pretty contemptible reason for being moral? Atheists are really moral. They don't murder their neighbors because they think it's wrong to do so for all sorts of reasons that, as you say, predate religion.
So let's talk about language. Is there a distinction between being an atheist and a humanist? Because I think I see the word humanist used much more frequently these days. Is that just running away from an unpopular word?
There are various unkind things one could say about running away from an unpopular word, and there are various schools of thought. Some people think that atheists should abandon the word because it has acquired so many negative connotations. Others feel that what we have to do is to give it positive connotations. An atheist, after all, is just somebody who holds a different philosophical position in quite a sophisticated way from what many other people do. As we said at the beginning, nobody really knows whether there are gods or not, and it's reasonable to hold the view that there aren't. It doesn't all automatically make you evil. The word humanist has a more positive spin. It's a positive view of life. We are humans. We have only one life. That's where the atheist comes in. We're not going to have another one. It's up to us to make of life what we can. We try to do the best for the whole of humanity. I prefer to generalize that and say the whole of sentient animals as well. We don't want to
Yes, humanist sounds a little speciesist.
It sounds a bit speciesist, and that's one of the problems with it. But I think that to call yourself a humanist is a pretty good thing to call yourself. I think the great majority of humanists actually are atheists, but they prefer to emphasize a positive attitude rather than what sounds rather negative.
Here's an email that asks, has the reaction to the book been very different in Great Britain and Europe than in the USA? What about Canada as opposed to the USA? Any place where the author has been surprised at the reaction one way or the other?
Well, that's interesting. I can't really speak for Europe at the moment because non-English translations haven't yet. I think the only one so far is Dutch. But in Britain, it has been very well received. It's on the Sunday Times bestseller list, has been for many months, which is sort of equivalent to the New York Times bestseller list, which has been on in this country for many months too. It is being very well received. It's also being very very much not well received, as you would imagine, among some religious circles. On my book tour of America, I was very agreeably surprised by the positive reception it got over and over again. And this is not just in the so-called blue states. This is in other places. This is in, say, Virginia and Kansas as well. I was getting terrific ovations for my presentations. And I think this is no credit, no great credit to me. I think what's going on is that there is a huge undercurrent of non-believing feeling in America, which has felt repressed, suppressed, almost persecuted. And to have somebody who comes, who goes around saying the things that they had always wanted to say, many people said this to me explicitly over and over again in the book signing queues. I had people saying, thank you for saying what I have always wanted to say but didn't feel I could.
Here's another email that says, this guy must be loads of fun to have over for the holidays. What do you do at Christmas?
I take it by holidays you mean Christmas. I've always been amused by the American euphemism for Christmas, the insisting on calling it holidays. This is nothing to do
you're proving her point.
With respecting the feelings of atheists. This is to do with respecting the feelings of Jews. And I'm perfectly happy to celebrate Christmas or whatever you like to call it. It's become a cultural thing. I'm all for culture. I'm all for following one's cultural roots, whether they're Jewish or Christian or whatever they are. Christmas has long since ceased to be a religious festival anyway.
Richard in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Richard Dawkins. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Dawkins and Brian. Mr. Dawkins, I take it you subscribe to the Big Bang Theory or the origin of the universe?
I'm not a physicist, but in that particular case, I have to go along with the consensus of physicists, which is yes.
Okay. Though you give full credence to biological evolution and dismiss what is called creationism, the Big Bang is in concept a kind of creation, and that much closer to a concept of a creator, if not an anthropomorphic one. Second, is not atheism the most absurd intellectual vanity, in that the atheist can't certainly predict what will happen in the next 5 minutes of life on Earth and can't see through a closed door to see what is on the other side, but the atheist would argue with confidence that there is no God?
Well, I take it you were not listening to the early part of the program.
I was.
There's no sense in which the Big Bang could be said to be close to the idea of a creator for reasons that I've already given.
But it's a creation.
It's not a creation by an intelligence. It's something that we don't understand. It's a coming into existence which physicists are now working on.
Is your position, as certain as you are of it, and the fact that it can't be disproved, a kind of faith in
and
of itself?
I was just coming to that. This thing about arrogance and confidence. I am not confident. I am not confident. It's religious people who are confident. I don't know. I am waiting for science to find out what the truth is. But the religious person, he absolutely knows. He knows there's a Trinity. He knows that Jesus was born of a virgin. All these things for which there's not the slightest shred of an evidence.
You sound pretty confident. You're 6.8 on a scale of 7 that you're sure that there's no God.
I have the same confidence as I do with fairies. I take it that our caller is pretty confident that there are no fairies. I have that level of confidence.
Wait, I have another caller.
Above all, I'm waiting to find out. I'm curious to find out.
Here's a caller who wants to react to the fairies analogy. Blanca in Crestwood, you're on WNYC.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good. Real quick, because we're running out of time.
Yes. My question was, he used fairies as the model, you know, to kind of illustrate how the belief in God is something that you can't prove or disprove, and same with fairies. But religion has been something that has been around in every culture you know. And
Unlike a belief in fairies.
Well, there lots of different religions have. I mean, there's Zeus, there's Thor and Wotan, there's Mithras, there's all kinds of different religions. They are all different. Why do you favour one religion rather than another? If you'd been born in ancient Greece, you'd presumably be worshipping Zeus.
One last thing, and Blanca, thank you. We have a minute left. Do you consider yourself spiritual? Because you privilege the rational mind, yet at the same time you're clearly moved, I know from your writings, by art and poetry. You use a lot of metaphor in your own writing. It's not the work of a dry, analytical mind. Does spiritual mean something to you?
In that sense, I am very spiritual, and one of my earlier books, Unweaving the Rainbow, is all about that. My view is that human spirituality, in the sense of poetry and wonder, is far better served by science and by rationality than it is by religion, which is pokey and parochial and small-minded by comparison.
You're going on O'Reilly tonight, I understand.
Yes.
That's going to be a little different from this.
I'm looking forward to it.
Have you done that before?
No, I haven't.
You wrote that op-ed in the Times about renaming atheists the Brights.
That was one. I was quite curious about whether that would work. The analogy is with homosexuals renaming themselves gays.
Taking back queer in words
that's
like that.
That's right, yes. And I don't really care much one way or the other. I'm quite interested to see whether a new coining can flourish in the memosphere, but I don't really mind one way or the other.
The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, published by Houghton Mifflin. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Nuala McGovern produced this program with Jim Colgan, Priya George, Lisa Allison, and Kate Hines. Help today from Nadia Zonis, and that's Alex Goldmark at the audio controls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.